Way News, I'm Michael Brown. Russian President Vladimir Putin has told U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that he would welcome a meeting with President Donald Trump on the sidelines of next month's G20 summit in Japan. Speaking through an interpreter, Putin told the secretary that he had spoken to Trump and hoped to rebuild the relationship between Moscow and Washington.
I had the pleasure of talking to the President of the United States on the phone, and I had the impression that the President intends to rebuild U.S.-Russian relations and contact in order to solve the issues of mutual interest.
Putin also repeated his denial that his government interfered in the U.S. 2016 presidential election. Earlier, Pompeo said he had warned Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov that the United States would not tolerate Russian interference in next year's presidential election. AP sources say the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has reached a deal with Donald Trump Jr. for an interview. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has reached agreement with Donald Trump Jr. for a closed-door interview next month, according to two people familiar with the agreement who spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity. Under terms of the deal, Trump Jr. will talk to the committee for up to 4 hours. Trump Jr. was subpoenaed last week by the committee to go over answers he gave to the panel staff in a 2017 interview about the Russia investigation. The committee set a Monday deadline for Trump to respond, but the panel reached out Monday night and terms were agreed to. Mike Gracia, Washington.
And Sudan's ruling Transitional Military Council and the Opposition of Freedom and Change Forces has agreed on a 3-year transition period during talks in Khartoum following last month's ouster of longtime ruler President Omar al-Bashir. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The head of the United Nations mission, charged with the implementation of a ceasefire in the contested Yemeni port of Hodeida, said on Tuesday that the withdrawal of fighting forces from the area could begin within a month if a plan is finalized. Lieutenant Michael Losgaard is head of the UN support mission.
And that means that the liaison officers from the other party will come here, will come to Rasisa, will come to Salif to see if the trenches are moved, or the manifestations are moved, that it's only the Coast Guard that are left in the ports. So there will be a verification afterwards.
The rebels said on Saturday that they had begun a long-delayed redeployment of its forces as part of a ceasefire reached in December. The redeployment forces from the key port of Hodeida, as well as two other smaller ports, is seen as an important first step toward ending the civil war in Yemen. The human rights group Amnesty International says it believes the Maduro regime committed crimes against humanity in Venezuela and wants the International Criminal Court to investigate. Amnesty says in a new report, there was a high level of coordination between security forces across Venezuela to neutralize or eliminate anyone who was even suspected of opposing President Nicolas Maduro, especially in impoverished areas. Amnesty is urging the United Nations Human Rights Council to set up a panel of inquiry at its upcoming session next month, and wants the International Criminal Court in The Hague to consider action against the Maduro government. President Rodrigo Duterte's allies appear to have overwhelming leads in elections for the Philippines. Senate, one of the opposition's last bulwarks against a brash populist leader, accused of massive human rights violations. Preliminary results, comprising 94% of returns of the midterm elections, showed at least 8 candidates endorsed by Duterte were leading in races for 12 seats in the 24-member Senate. Official Commission on Election results are expected to be declared in about a week. Duterte, has shown little tolerance, for critics, especially those who question his anti-drug campaign, aimed for stronger leverage in the traditionally more independent Senate to bolster his legislative agenda. And Sri Lankan government official said mob attacks on Muslim communities in the country's northwest since Monday have left one person dead, dozens of shops and mosques destroyed. Police say the situation was brought under control and no incidents were reported on late Tuesday. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. All ballot papers for Malawi's May 21st general election have been delivered.
The 50 prints came on Monday, bringing all local government elections and half of parliamentary. And the secret vote came on Tuesday, bringing all the presidential elections and half of the parliamentary.
Sangwani Mwafulira is the spokesman for the Malawi Elections Commission. Amnesty International appeals to the next Malawi government to end impunity for attacks on people with albinism. Africa is uniquely positioned to take advantage of a blue economy. Zimbabweans air their anger over economic meltdown. And Liberian President George Weah has met with organizers of the planned June 7 anti-government protest.
As long as we continue to protest, there will be, of course, economic issues. So let it be mindful that it's also helping to bring the economy down.
That's Liberian President George Weah, but the organizers say they are determined to protest on June 7. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi has taken delivery of all ballot papers for the country's May 21st general election. Malawi Elections Commission spokesman Sangwani Mwafulira says the commission invited all political parties to witness the arrival and warehousing of the ballot papers to ensure transparency.
We are printing the ballot papers in Dubai for three elections, that's the presidential, parliamentary, and the local government. The ballot papers have been delivered to Malawi in two trips. The first print came on Monday, bringing all local government elections and half of parliamentary. And the secret route came on Tuesday, bringing all the presidential elections and half of the parliamentary. Considering how sensitive ballot papers are, the commission has tried everything possible to be transparent about the process. We invited the political parties, civil society, to be there to monitor or witness the arrival and the warehousing of the ballot papers. No one wants access, have access to it until the day of dispatching to the councils. That will be the 16th.
So, Sangwani, tell me, what means do you have to transport the ballots to the different areas of the country?
Well, we got several means. Most of the parts we are delivering by road because we are no longer now in the rainy season. We can access all the councils by road minus where we need to go by boat. But now we fly the ballots to that area because it's an island. What I should mention is that we are delivering these ballot papers to the councils. On the 17th and 18th, the councils will be dispatching the ballot papers to the centers. It's a big exercise because we've got about 5,000 centers, and some of them might even be hard to reach. So we got boats that we're going to use to take the ballot papers to these places. And also want to mention that as we are sending out the ballot papers, we are sending them under the escort of the defense forces just to ensure that they are safe and no one cannot tamper with them.
Again, what contingency plans do you have in case, maybe due to bad roads, that some of the vehicles that are going to transport the ballots cannot get there to their destinations? What are some of your contingency plans?
We are planning for all scenarios. Supposedly that in one of the areas it rains, what you should know is that we are sending the board papers in advance. We're making sure that by 17th or 18th, all the centers have got their ballot papers, because on the 19th, we have a nationwide exercise for pre-inspection of all polling materials to ensure that each and every center has received the right quantity and in right order. Now, to answer your question, what happens if one area it has rained, there was a bridge, it's cut off? We have no choice but maybe to use either the boats to take the ballot papers to that area, or we even fly them to such areas.
Sangwane Mwafulira is the spokesman for the Malawi Elections Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Amnesty International has appealed to the next Malawian government to do everything in its power to end impunity for attacks on people with albinism. In a statement Tuesday, Amnesty International said next week's election will be taking place in the context of long-standing criminal justice failures and widespread impunity for the killing of people with albinism. Depros Muchena is Amnesty International's Regional Director for Southern Africa.
We are making this statement ahead of the national elections that take place next week on Tuesday. And we are placing on the attention of political leaders, political candidates, and essentially those who will form the next government, that it is vital that Malawi takes decisive action to ensure that the continued harassment, including killings and mutilation of persons with albinism and the commitment of atrocities against them, is something that should be buried to the annals of history. That a new government makes a fresh commitment to improving the criminal justice system, which is at the core of the failure by the state to protect the rights of persons with albinism.
The presidential election in Malawi are next week, the 21st. Do you think it's kind of late to demand for each presidential candidate, including President Mutharika himself, to come up with a policy on how to deal with the problems affecting people with albinism?
The point is this. Every political candidate is aware of this issue. It has been discussed, and that's why our message is to the new government, to the next government, that it must take decisive action in order to ensure that trials that have not been concluded are concluded, and that senior magistrates are appointed to look over these cases, and that we put this matter to a decisive end so that people with albinism can enjoy their rights.
The current government led by President Mutharika, what do you think about the policies that the government has put forward so far in dealing with the issue people with albinism?
I think it has been a challenge for the government of the day to deal decisively with impunity, but to also address attitudes in society, because this is not just driven by state failings. It's also driven by attitudes in society where deep-seated beliefs about the mythical power of body parts of a person with albinism, as long as those deep-seated myths are embedded in the people's culture, then you will see that the movement that tortures, that kills, and that hunts people with albinism will just go underground. So there ought to be a massive human rights education to demystify these myths and to ensure that protection mechanisms go beyond sort of cosmetic things that you were talking about, of whistles and so on. We need a comprehensive social protection program, a comprehensive legal reform agenda, and a comprehensive criminal justice reform program. And that's why we need, in the August SADC summit, the governments of Southern Africa must come together and deal with these problems, because they are also happening in Tanzania, in Mozambique, in South Africa, and Swaziland, and Malawi becoming the epicenter.
Depros Muchena is Amnesty International's Regional Director for Southern Africa, who is speaking with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Africa is uniquely positioned to take advantage of a blue economy, which will capitalize on environmentally friendly development options related to oceans. Africa Blue Economic Forum founder Leila Ben-Hansen spoke to Ricky Stryak about the potential and the pitfalls.
38 countries in Africa are coastal. 90% of the trade in Africa is through the sea. In the next 20 years, so the number of young people will double. By 2050, we will have 1 billion young people. If we look to so many figures happening right now in Africa, we'll understand how urgent and important for Africa to have a lot of strategy and resources dedicated to the blue economy. We now have to take the blue economy seriously and as a priority for the sustainable growth in the continent.
Are there any examples of countries in Africa or projects in Africa that are already working to develop the blue economy?
Yes, there are already some countries who are pioneers when it comes to the blue economy. For example, the Seychelles, they have a dedicated ministry and minister for the blue economy. Mauritius is the same. And more we can see countries adopting. Last year, Africa, like in Kenya, they did a very big event about sustainable blue economy, where the president, he showed commitment in projects in with other international companies and countries. So there are countries, they already adopted also some projects in the blue economy, but not necessarily they will say, oh, it is within the blue economy. But when we talk about blue economy generally, there are three aspects who are extremely important. So number one, we talk about economy. So finance and money is extremely important, what we generate out of the project. Then secondly, it's extremely important to pay into attention the environment. So we should not have, for example, a big industry, but we are polluting the environment. We can't talk about fisheries and then the sea is extremely dirty and we have a lot of dead fish around.
And if the ocean is looked at as an investment in a financial term, what are the risks of leaving behind people who have less financial means in environmentally friendly movements?
That's a good question. You are right. Nowadays, we really need to have innovative financing, because you are right. When we talk in general, as you want a concrete example, let's take a simple example of fishermen. So fisherman, he doesn't have a lot of financial resources. So he has his boat, but he has also, because we talk about sustainability, he has to respect the rules, how many fish he can, or kilos or whatever a day he can have or a month. And then if you want to scale it up, he doesn't have the finance to scale up and grow his business. So we need the banks. And sometimes the banks, they don't give loans or the financial support to the small businesses. Here we need innovative solution. Maybe the private equities can involve. Maybe there are different ways of financing and financial institutions that can help.
That was Leila Ben-Hansen, founder of the Africa Blue Economic Forum. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. Today's Wednesday, May 15th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Zimbabweans grappling with poverty as the economy continues to struggle are using every chance they get to air their anger at the government. One such incident happened over the weekend at a government-organized meeting in the town of Chihoya, a place where the ruling ZANU-PF party can normally count on rock-solid support. Colombo's Mavunga reports.
Pro-government statements are the norm in Chinoye, the hometown of former President Robert Mugabe. But that was not the case at a public meeting Saturday. Doug Taylor Frame, a former leader of the predominantly white Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union, was among those who spoke.
When President came into power, he made an appeal to the world. Please can all those financial institutions come into Zimbabwe and bring investment here. Our president, there's no need for him to be traveling all around the world looking for this money. It's here. But we just need the right documentation so we can put the right security in place. And I promise you, overnight, there will be a huge change.
When he speaks of documentation, Freem is talking about giving farmers the legal right to their land. Most white commercial farmers were pushed off their land in the early 2000s by the government and replaced by black peasant farmers. Those new farmers have no guarantee they'll be allowed to stay and no collateral to use to borrow money from banks. Without those, Frame argues, the farms cannot be productive. Even blacks who benefited from the land reforms, like tobacco farmer Ronnie Masango, say unless the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe addresses chronic shortages of cash and finds a way to preserve the value of the local currency, the bond note, the Southern African country's economy will not recover. I hear people keep on saying, parallel market, parallel market. Where is that money coming from? Asks Masango. At the banks, I cannot access my money. But in the streets, I see people using cash as their tools, he said. We want cash in the banks, not in the streets. so you'll soon see commotion in the streets since traders show off. Parallel market is the source of our economic problems. That is where corruption starts. Ziyambi Ziyambi, Zimbabwe's Minister of Justice, says only patience will help as the country goes through what President Mnangagwa calls austerity for prosperity measures to reverse years of recession under former President Mugabe.
To be fair to Reserve Bank does not create a parallel market. A parallel market or a black market is created by shortages. So what we are doing is to come up with austerity measures. The moment we have a scenario where our production increases, we kill the parallel market. We have to acknowledge that we have had 20 years or so where there was no development.
It remains to be seen if the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe can assure citizens and farmers like Ronnie Masango that the economy will stabilize. There was a round of nationwide demonstrations in January when fuel prices increased. The opposition has indicated that more protests will materialize unless things improve. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chinoyi, Zimbabwe.
Liberian President George Manuel Weah has told organizers of a June 7 anti-government protest to rethink their plans for the peace and stability of the country. Mr. Weah made the appeal on Tuesday when he met with the Council of Patriots, organizers of the protest. Organizers have dubbed the June 7 protest Save the State protest to express their concerns about what they are calling the country's current worsening economic situation and corruption. President Weah said his administration is doing all it can to fix the economy, but he said his administration would never try to stop any citizen from speaking to their government. He said protesting now would only bring more hardship on the citizens who, he said, are already feeling the pinch of a dismal economy.
The settlers' instability protest is not the best way. So this is why we're here to lead to dialogue. Is that the only way to talk about what happened in our country is to get in the street. Mind you, we have our economic issues according to all of us. Every time we get in the street, it costs us two times what we are looking for. To pay for community, I spend about $300,000 to $400,000, and the community, the dwellers are happy. To get to the street to make sure that we got protesters, it costs me over million plus United States. That money could be going to fixing our community roads instead of going to pull security in the street, logistics, and what have you. So as long as we continue to protest, there will be, of course, economic issues. So let it be mindful that it's also helping to bring the economy down. But never we ask of any citizen to speak to the government. I'm not saying that you're going to stop protesters from protesting. I mean, that they're right to protest. But what I'm saying that it is necessary to protest. But what you're going to say in the street, you cannot say on the table. The list you're going to send for somebody to go receive, and he would have got a list here. So that we can continue the dialogue and find the reasons why you want to protest and what have you. We can talk about it, but we still desire to protest. It's all right. We ask the Justice Minister to make sure that they guard you, they protect you. So I want to ask you to make sure that we sit on the table and talk about our differences.
That was Liberian President George Weah speaking in Monrovia Tuesday when he met with organizers of the coming June 7th anti-government protest. Meanwhile, organizers of the planned June 7th anti-government protest in Liberia say their protest will take place despite an appeal from President George Weah for the protesters to reconsider their plan. Darius Dalen is spokesman for the Council of Patriots, organizers of the protest.
Our concern is simple, that he should guarantee that he will uphold the Constitution and create the enabling environment to provide security protection for Liberian citizens who are seeking and preparing and determined to a summer beginning June 7 to express their grievances to the government and petition the government on governance issues.
You heard what the president said. What is it that you want on June 7th that you cannot bring about through consultation?
The Liberian people, the country itself, is feeling the pinch of bad governance, poor governance. The issue about the economy, no life, no vision, no practical approach to take us out of this quagmire. Our economy is in the toilet. The president needs to tell us what is his vision plan for this country. Where are we going as the people and country? The economic hardship in this country is terrible. Our people are suffering increasingly than ever before. The president in the meeting today acknowledged it, but he said he's doing well. When there's a problem and you insist you're doing well, then there is actually a problem. And that problem is no solution inside. And the ordinary people who are feeling the brunt of this matter have decided that they want to show up. It's going to be unfair to them not to allow them to do so. And so beginning June 7, the Liberian people will start to come up in their numbers to express these grievances and others.
As the president said, the government is not against Liberians gathering to protest. But at the same time, he said that such a protest can have negative impact on the same economic concerns that you have. Are you not also concerned about that?
If we weren't concerned, we would not be thinking about assembling in a peaceful and orderly manner. James, let's get it straight. Nowhere in a serious, strong, and pure democracy that protests can have effect on an economy. For 12 years, George Weah and his CDC party protested on Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. But because the early administration was more democratic and allowing people to express their democratic franchise, Liberia's economy was not this bad. We need to understand what is George Weah's vision for this country.
There are some people, some sympathizers of the government who say that you, the organizers of this protest, are being pushed by people whose intent is to see President George Weah's government fail.
The government is failing itself. The government should stop shifting blame.
Darius Dillon is spokesman for the Council of Patriots, organizers of the planned June 7th anti-government protest in Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Malawi has taken delivery of all ballot papers for the country's May 21st general election. Malawi Elections Commission spokesman Sangwani Mwafulira says the commission invited all political parties to witness the arrival and warehousing of the ballot papers to ensure transparency. Meanwhile, Amnesty International has appealed to the next Malawian government to do everything in its power to end impunity for attacks on people with albinism. In a statement on Tuesday, Amnesty said next week's election will be taking place in the context of long-standing criminal justice failures and widespread impunity for the killing of people with albinism. The sound of gunfire echoed late into the evening Monday in Khartoum as security forces clashed with demonstrators almost immediately after Sudan's ruling military council announced it had reached an agreement with protest leaders on a transitional authority. Firing tear gas and live bullets and beating protesters, armed men in uniform descended on barricades set up by protesters, witnesses said, killing several and wounding dozens. Sudan's ruling transitional military council blamed unidentified elements for the attack and said one military police officer, an army major, was among the victims. But it was unclear who was responsible for the shooting. And that's it for this Wednesday, May 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.